Hello?
Who's this?
Who are you trying to reach?
Wait, I was just wondering what you're doing tonight.
Just getting ready to listen to a podcast.
Ooh, you like podcasts? What's your favorite podcast?
Oh, just Percolated Media's Three Men in a Retrospective podcast where they look at various franchises one film at a time.
Really? Is that the one with Garrett, Adam, and Matt?
Yeah, this next month and a half, they'll be looking at the Scream series, where two of them haven't watched past the fourth film of the series.
You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
Because I want to know who I'm looking at.
Scream 2, released December 12, 1997. Budget on this was $24 million. Box office, $172.4 million. And this was once again directed by our buddy Matt, Mr. Wes Craven. Oh my God, not even a year later. After Scream came out and was a massive success, I don't think it was out 2 weeks before we had already heard that there was going to be a sequel. Apparently, Kevin Williamson had written a five-page treatment, and less than a year later, here we are at Scream 2. Adam, I know I was there opening day. Were you with us? I don't think you were this time, were you?
I wasn't, and I was trying to remember how I saw this because I vaguely remember the movie. So I had to go back and look up the dates. I was in the service at this time.
Oh, that's right.
I was about a week from finishing basic training. So I didn't get home until I think the Wednesday or Thursday after this. And then when I got home that next week, there was a little movie that took precedence that we did see the very next week. A little movie called Titanic.
Oh, that's right.
And that was the movie that came out the day that I got home. And I can't remember when I saw this. I know I've only seen it once before this, maybe twice, because I remembered a few things. But yeah, I don't know when I did, but it definitely was not opening weekend because I wasn't in the state and I was getting yelled at by my drill sergeant still.
I've forgotten that you and Omar were both in the service at this time. So yeah, this was a solo date. I was with my girlfriend at the time. Adam, you remember her. You know, and I remember coming out of it liking it quite a bit. I had a pretty good time with this initially, but I have not revisited it since Matt, you and I reviewed this set of years ago. Matt, what were you expecting coming into Scream 2 after you had seen the first one?
Well, knowing the reputation of horror sequels, it's not like I could go in with the most amount of confidence, but I love that even though it's a new decade and a new generation of horror, it's the 80s model of, hey, this thing made a shitload of money, crap out a sequel as fast as you can.
That's pretty much what they did. Again, less than a year. But you know what, Matt? You and I have talked about so many goddamn Friday the 13th, and we are going to get to the Halloween franchise eventually. And Nightmare on Elm Street, that's the way horror movies go, isn't it? You get a sequel out there, and you prey upon those teenagers who went and made you money the first time, right?
Yes, but it's surprising because, well, I should say, it's only surprising in this sense that we're now in an era where slasher films have kind of been revitalized, but not in the way of the supernatural like the 80s were. That's kind of the direction they were going with Scream 2. But I think one of the things that kind of benefited this movie was there was no real competition as far as horror franchises around this time. By this point, Jason was sent to hell. Michael Myers was sent to hell as far as quality goes. And Freddy had had his new nightmare and then was put to bed. So Ghostface was standing alone.
He was standing alone. And as we detailed last week, there's a reason for that, because those franchises you just mentioned had taken a really bad dip. People were not going to those anymore. And this was that solo horror franchise. And you know what? This was the first thing to do, boys, this film. It was the first film that I can recall where we heard the quote-unquote internet leaks be uttered, because this script was completed. Kevin Williamson did turn in his draft, a few drafts actually. They were working on it, and wouldn't you know it, we had the ending leaked onto the internet. They did massive rewrites and they rewrote the end of this film. We will talk about it when we get to it. But Adam, do you remember hearing that oh boy, we have a little thing called the internet to worry about when it comes to leaks about certain franchises?
I do, and I find it pretty astounding that this movie still can't. I mean, a year later, other than Saw, I find it hard to believe when franchises put out a film the next year. Horror is about the only one that can get away with that. But yeah, this, you knew about it, and it was leaked like the entire third act. And then they came out and was just like, I think at first they were just like, oh, that's not true. And then it was, oh, we changed it. And then it was, oh, we got multiple options, so nobody knows what's real. And then it was, we gave people a fake script, so it's not true. Yeah, the real script got leaked. And I think they did film, I think, 4 or 5 different versions of this ending. And they cobbled together what they did. But yeah, this was one where, oh boy, it could have completely derailed everything. You know, because this, much like other franchises that get off on a big bounce, the twist is what hooks you. And without that there, this wouldn't have lasted.
Matt, do you remember reading about that at all?
Yeah, I was sitting in preschool on my Macintosh.
I'm talking about when you watched the goddamn
thing. No, I know. Just don't ruin my joke. It's appropriate that a movie about copycats, to a certain degree, was ruined by spoilers on the internet, which was topical because the internet was becoming more powerful, to the point where we're only a few years removed from everyone thinking it was going to lead to a nuclear holocaust or the Terminator timeline. But it's unfortunate, but I think sometimes you can go into a movie, if a movie is good, you can recognize its quality independent of knowing the twist. I sort of call it the Empire Strikes Back principle, where so many people knew Darth Vader was Luke's father even before they saw the movie because of the notoriety of that scene. I'm excluding, of course, the people who saw it back when it first came out. Okay. But that type of well-known reveal doesn't ruin Empire for a lot of people, even though, like, kids, some go in knowing that twist. The late 80s, early 90s, we were getting a lot of movies, though, that were built around going in expecting a twist. Usual Suspects was a big one. The first Scream. And sometimes you got unexpected ones that worked, like the Kevin Costner, No Way Out.
Oh, God, that's such a good fucking name. I just watched that movie for the first time maybe 2-3 years ago. It is unbelievable, the twist in that movie. So good. This was a big deal. And like I mentioned, I was there opening weekend. I was stoked. And everybody who survived last film, they returned here. Their egos hadn't gotten in the way yet. Wes Craven returned to direct, even though there were rumors that Robert Rodriguez was going to turn up and direct it. He went on to do The Faculty, which I'll talk about more of that next week, because I finally watched that for the first time, thanks to these boys. Even though he does get a credit in this, but that is all parody. But Matt, our buddy Wes Craven, we had some pretty good raves about him last week. Did you think he could turn in a good film again? Or what did you think when you saw, oh boy, Wes Craven's back for this?
My natural inclination was to call it a fluke, but I also thought it was him kind of in his mind saying, okay, I can't do the same thing that I did with Nightmare, where I turned the sequel to another person and then bitched about what they did because it wasn't in line with my vision when I sold it off, and kind of, you can't call ownership to that degree anymore. So maybe this was his way of kind of saying, here's what I would have done with Nightmare to a certain extent, that I'll actually do the sequel down to directing.
Well, it feels like kind of a trade-off because, Matt, you and I have discussed this a lot over the years. We'll probably discuss it again if we ever get back to Nightmare. But he had been trying for so long to get out of the horror genre. And the Weinsteins had actually promised him a movie we'll talk about when we get to next week's film, where he had this movie with Meryl Streep, Music of the Heart. It was his trade-off to do this sequel and I think next week's film in order to get that particular film. So he was trying so hard to get out of the quote-unquote ghetto of the horror genre that I think it kind of pigeonholed him, didn't it?
You also have to take into effect that Vampire in Brooklyn was a massive turd. That also kind of put the kibosh on him trying to do something different.
Of course. And working on that movie, he had no good things to say about Eddie Murphy, as nobody does when they work with him. All right. So, oh, Adam, Wes Craven, you are the one of the three of us who really enjoys New Nightmare. You came into this. You saw Wes Craven's name was on this. Were you worried about the quality of it?
I was. I'm worried about the quality of every single film after the first one. Horror, a lot of times, is diminishing returns. But I remember this thing turning into a joke franchise really quickly and being nothing but might as well be direct-to-TV, direct-to-VHS type movies. So I just don't remember anything. This one, I remembered one or two glimpses. That was it. The third one, might as well say it now. The only thing I remember is Courtney Cox's haircut. So,
oh, geez.
Knowing how quickly this came back and knowing everybody that was involved, yeah, my expectations were about as low as you could be.
All right, so let's get into what the results of those expectations were. We start off, we get the Weinstein and Miramax logo as Dimension Films pops up, and we cut to a premiere of Stab, the story of the Woodsboro murders that we saw last week. And we see Don't Talk About My Wife, Jada Pinkett Smith here, along with Foreman from House. They're arguing over the fact that they are going to a scary movie and whether they should be watching this or a movie with a naked Sandra Bullock. All right. A lot to cover already, boys. Matt, what'd you think about the idea that they have already made a movie based on last week's film called Stab, and we are going to the premiere of it?
I think this is actually one of the strongest aspects of the movie, because the first film played a lot with conventions. This one does that, but also applies it more to real life circumstances. In particular, this is riding the wave of the TV movie of like true crime. That was very prominent in like the late 80s into the 90s. Everything from, you know, there was a John Gotti movie with Armand Assante, to you had like lower end, call it murder porn, as South Park would call it. But
Drew Barrymore played Amy Fisher in one of them.
Yeah. I mean, not only that, but it's also kind of ahead of its time with how quick we are to try to make a quick buck off of tragedy. I mean, look at how quickly they make movies after like a mass shooting, or to the point of our fascination with serial killers. How many documentaries about John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer have we gotten over the past like 5 years? So I think this is actually in a movie that sometimes I think is not as clever as it thinks it is. It gets out of the gate though sprinting pretty well.
Okay, before I get to Adam, let me retort that a little bit, because I think last week's movie we talked about it was so clever in the way it kind of sended up the Friday the 13th series, and we had the Halloween series where when Drew Barrymore mentioned Halloween, she's pulling out a knife, and that's their callback to Halloween. This movie is calling back to one movie and one movie only, and that's Scream. And I think that is my summarization of my feelings on the quality of it. I think it pigeonholed itself into making itself a parody of last week's film and not necessarily a statement on any other genre. Matt, would you agree with that?
To a large degree, I would. There are times when they do make reference to other films, but they're not necessarily horror exclusive in that genre. So I think you're somewhat accurate, but I will go so far as to say this thing is a parody. It doesn't quite become, you know, the thing it set out to satirize, but there are certainly aspects in this one that I think are a lot broader than the references in the first film, to where it's not so much, it's sort of the opposite of Inside Baseball, where they go too big with the references because they're so obvious, like with the sequel conversation later on. The movies they reference, which we'll get into, are the ones everybody knows. And the first one did that by referencing Friday the 13th and other notable movies, but they were much more subtle with the direct references, like pulling the knife out, to your point, or some people argue about Wes Craven as the janitor wearing the Freddy sweater. This one, they're much more direct with what they're referencing. And I sometimes think that is to the movie's detriment.
Okay, Adam, that's a lot to take in. First of all, give me your feelings on the fact that we are going to a premiere of a movie based on last week's film and what we just talked about as far as what genre this thing is representing, what movie this is representing.
Starting it off with basically the crowd seeing the movie, I get what they're doing. At the same time, oh my God, I would firebomb this theater because this fucking crowd. This is the most obnoxious crowd. I don't care if it's a fan fest. This is the most annoying crowd possible. But this thing slips into scary movie territory, and I need the parody for this entire opening, except for a few parts. Like, this is all the way down to making a stereotypical black couple, which they inserted one other black person in this theater, because I literally had to pause it and I was like, is he going this offensive? Like, they're loud talking, they're doing that kind of stuff. And look, Jada Pinkett at that time, you know what? She was better in the Matrix video game than she was in the Matrix. And
she was Tales from the Crypt, right? That was her one claim to fame right up until this point.
Until this point, yeah.
Oh, and she was also in Love and Basketball or something, wasn't she?
She had done some of those. Talking just like mainstream, yeah.
Well, I would tell you, because she was well known because she did Menace to Society and was the main love interest in The Nutty Professor, which was a big hit.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
True, true. Yep. And, you know, Omar Epps, I forgot he was actually in this opening. I remembered her, but not him. But this is annoying until it's not. Towards the end of this, I think it actually gets really, really good. But the way that it goes back and forth with being annoying to me wanting to slap the shit out of everybody that's in this theater, and then me realizing that it's at the Egyptian in LA, not the Grauman. Like, there's cool little stuff here. But, man, this is a parody of a movie that gets parodied. Yeah. And that's hard. I do not think the opening to this movie, and I'm going to talk about maybe the opening like 25, 30 minutes, is any good at all.
Interesting.
Now, when it comes to Epps and what happens to him as it's coming up and before he gets the knife in the ear, suddenly I'm like, oh, I remember this part. And that is still ridiculously freaking effective. Like, that is an amazing horror kill. I think it's freaking great. But then you have to look at then what happens to Jada and playing it up like it's a freaking comedy on stage. It is so uneven the way that this movie starts.
All right. So you touched on something I want to get into with this opening. The first film, I think, does a remarkable job of putting horror in suburbia, but without going too far into making everyone just like yuppies. Mm-hmm. And that movie also pulls off the whole thing of how do we make like a house party have suspense? You know, because a lot of the scares in that movie, some of them take place during the day. I mean, some of the big ones take place at night, obviously, but all the situations feel very realistic. This one is way too exaggerated for me to take it as seriously as I could in the first one. I don't think the first midnight screening of The Phantom Menace was this ridiculous.
I was thinking that exact thing. It's funny you mentioned that. It was in my notes that I wouldn't experience this for like an hour and a half. But even those screenings weren't nearly as rowdy as this. I mean, look, going to horror films in the late 80s and 90s, we talk about theatrical experiences now. It wasn't like this, but you had people screaming over things. My screening of Candyman 2 was perhaps the most annoying experience I've ever had, because we had somebody just talking throughout the entire goddamn thing. There are no horror sequels. There's no horror film. There's hardly any science fiction films or comic book films that get as much fucking fans and people into it as this one is.
When I took Garrett to see Rocky Horror Picture Show, the crowd wasn't as animated as this.
That's true.
That's what this should be. This should be like a send-up of Rocky Horror, because you have everyone wearing the Ghostface costume, and they're literally throwing popcorn at the screen. Like, if you know Rocky Horror Picture Show, Rice plays a big component. Mm. So I think they could have gone that direction, but sometimes I think this movie, it's too broad for me to take it 100% seriously, which you can do with the first one, despite all of its self-reflectiveness and winking at the audience. It plays as a legitimately suspenseful horror movie when it needs to. In this movie, there are those scenes, but they're not as successfully woven into the overall tone as I think it is in the first one.
I feel like every single one of these conversations, we're going to be talking like an hour about the opening scene. Here we go. Jada is talking about how much the African-American element is misrepresented in the horror genre, and we get every 90s reference here. We get Black Eyed Peas. This stamps it in the 90s.
They're still popular. Hell, Naked Gun, that's one of the funniest bits in the new one.
That's a good point. They get a studio-sent costume as we see this theater, as you mentioned, Matt, is in a Star Wars-like frenzy waiting for this thing to start. Everyone has masks and glow-in-the-dark knives as we see the opening with a house, and we have Heather Graham here playing the Drew Barrymore role. You know, I find it weird that... Here's what I'll say. I like this in concept. I like the way Drew Barrymore never got naked and jumped in a shower. But here we have an opening scene. This chick is in the shower. Matt, how'd you feel about the way the opening scene from last week's film is ended up here?
Well, I like this send up because it's the definition of studio license, where they're thinking of strictly commodity, not being 100% factual, where, okay, she wasn't naked, but that sex sells. Put it in the movie. Which, that's the whole thing of like biopics and this type of film. You don't go for 100% historical accuracy. There's going to be a lot of exaggerations. And I like that inclusion, because that is also in line with the type of send-ups that the first film did. Mm-hmm. You know, directly calling out that if you get naked or make any reference to your sexuality, you're marking yourself for death. So I think this, right down to the production value in this movie looking like a cheap set, reflects studios just trying to make a quick buck off of other people's misfortune.
Yeah, and I do think it's him kind of referencing what he's used to in this type of genre, especially with horror. So yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the concept I think is a smart one, and the writing of it, I think, hey, you're pushing out something as quick as you can. You're going to put what you know, and you're going to keep in that type of meta genre. I just don't think it's as successful as they thought it was going to be when the entire scene is taken into account.
To clear up, when you say him, do you mean Williamson or Craven?
Williamson. I'm talking about specifically the way he wrote it. But then Craven, I do think he's shooting some of this like, this is what I've had to deal with already for 20, 25 years at that point.
So Jada is asking for money to go get some snacks, and she walks a bit and hears some screams coming from the theater as she orders a medium popcorn and Pepsi. She overhears a conversation about how this is based on a true story as Jada is snuck up on by Foreman, and she says she doesn't like being scared like that.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Jada Pinkett being involved in an entanglement should not be surprising. I half expected the killer to take off the mask, and it was Chris Rock.
Jesus Christ. Foreman says that scary movies are a great form of foreplay, and then he says that he has to go to the bathroom. She goes back inside as scenes are being recreated by members of the crowd, and we see Foreman taking a leak amongst two dudes wearing a mask. By the way, how bad of an idea is it that this is based on these murders and you have these masks everywhere? What the hell do you guys think was going to happen?
Also, how do you piss in that ghost face robe?
Yeah, exactly.
If I walk into a bathroom, there's two dudes standing at a urinal with masks on. Nope.
Yeah, go.
Nope.
Says the guy who loves Eyes Wide Shut.
Fidelio.
He goes inside a stall for some privacy as he overhears more foreplay or something from the other end. What the hell is he hearing on the other end of this fucking bathroom wall?
Okay, so this I have a huge problem with, because the first film with the killers, everything's kind of predicated on when you find out there's two people, you can see the logic in everything, how they handle proximity and stuff. This movie relies a lot on convenience. In a theater this big, Mickey, or whichever one of the killers it is, I assume it's Mickey, sat on the toilet for God knows how long, waiting for this particular guy to walk in.
That's assuming that either of the killers is the killer here at this scene.
Oh, I think it's clear that this is one of those killers in the beginning.
Do you?
I do.
Because I don't think anything in here is tied in by the end of it other than Gail's book.
Well, given who we thought was going to be one of the killers, which we'll talk about at the end, I do think this was supposed to tie in. But
yeah, and I'm with that logic as well, because you could also look at this in the way that some of the James Bond films are sequences independent of the overarching story or the one that's going to follow.
Yeah, so Foreman does the unsmart thing of putting his face to the wall, and he gets a knife to the ear. Ouch.
In certain bathrooms, you get something else.
Luckily, there wasn't a hole in this stall.
The guy or girl who did this looks at the knife and then at himself in the mirror as Foreman is face down. We go back to Jada in the theater, still reenacting what she's seeing as the guy in the mask sits down next to her. He says that he doesn't want any popcorn as more scenes from Stab are being shown. Jada notices when she picks her hands up from his clothes that there's blood on them. She screams and is stabbed and stands as everybody thinks this is part of the show. She's chased until he just stabs her in the back, and she's crawling on the floor until she screams by the screen and dies in front of the mask being shown on the screen. And Adam, to your point, this is so goddamn theatrical. This death, I know she begged Craven. She's like, I want to be like killed in like a big, big way in this movie. Of course, she wants to be the center of the attention. But this is just way too much, isn't it?
I mean, it's high school theater, yeah. Which is funny based on what happens 2/3 of the way through this film, but the way that it's being played is like it's a spoof, and you're spoofing something that's already a meta. I mean her decision to do it this way and Craven's decision to allow it makes it non-serious.
It makes me realize that everyone in this theater is a complete moron. Professional wrestling fans are better at realizing, oh, that was not supposed to happen, than the people in this theater, and we are specifically going in with lowered expectations to a lot of shows.
After this scene, we cut to a phone ringing, and we see that Sydney is getting prank called, which she spots and calls out right away. And she's visited by her roommate, Hallie, played by Elise Neal. Now, this chick, I'll go ahead and spoil it right now. This was supposed to be one of the killers. She's here, and then we see her get killed about 3/4 of the way in. My God, what is up with this character, Matt?
This screams of rewrites at the expense of reducing the importance of her character. Maybe she had more scenes that they cut when they had to pivot and not make her the killer as originally intended. I mean, look, this thing has more alternate endings than Clue did when you do the production history. So I actually think that would have, to a certain extent, I would have preferred that because you could have also played off the, I don't know, oh God, what was that? Not the perfect guy, or I love the roommate from hell type of movies. And you could have had fun with that, where she's like the stalker that lives with you and you don't even. I
Single
think
white
that
female.
would really, yes. Oh, single white female. That's exactly what I was thinking of. But you could have had a lot of fun with, because that's a trope that the first one is the boyfriend from hell. This one could be like the best friend or the stalker, especially because this movie has a lot to say about like the nature of unwanted celebrity and unwanted fame, which you really could have capitalized on with her character. But she's in and out so much that I half expect her to walk in with a double double. I'm glad you didn't groan at that joke because I worked really hard on that.
That was really good. I give you credit on that one, sir. Adam,
I don't even live in California, but on the West Coast, we don't have in and out here.
I think it would have been a smart way to go. I actually like the idea because not only, as Matt said, you play on that single white female, but you eliminate the black person gets killed at the very beginning, which you already did to open this movie, but then you already have a final girl that you know is going to make it to it, presumably. So you take another one. You take a race that traditionally, and they've called it out in every movie, doesn't make it to the end of the film, and you make that person your killer. That is something smart to do. That is a way that you actually go ahead and flip something and have your meta commentary that they started here at the beginning again. Good decision. And yeah, I think, man, assembly cut this, put out four different versions of it. Let us see what you filmed. But I think it's kind of clear by just the amount of faces that you have throughout this film that there was a lot of ways this thing was set up.
So as these two are talking, we're seeing an interview with accused killer who is now out due to being wrongfully accused, Cotton Weary, played by Liev Schreiber, and the interviewer is actually Kevin Williamson, which I thought was an interesting bit of trivia.
It's cool.
Hey Tarantino, this is how you put yourself in your movies.
No shit.
Don't call attention to yourself.
Sydney says that she's not sure she can make the party with Hallie tonight, and Hallie tells her to just loosen up. And then we're seeing a newscast about the murders we saw in the beginning, as Sydney is being hounded by reporters while she's leaving. And we're seeing a class with Craig Shoemaker, that's the teacher, where he's arguing with this class. One of the students is Buffy herself, Sarah Michelle Gellar. Another is returning Randy, and of course, Mickey, played by Timothy Oliphant. All right, well, I like the fact that we're seeing Sarah Michelle Gellar here, even though this is the only time we see her, and they had to do this in reshoots because she was not here for this. They had to cut back and forth between her and the actual scene itself. I like seeing Buffy. Timothy Oliphant has those fucking scary ass eyes. Every single one of his films, it's kind of obvious that he's the killer, although this is our ultra intro to him. But how do we feel about this scene, guys, where they're arguing over sequels, which were better than the first, including all the ones we've heard, Aliens, T2, Godfather 2, and House 2. Interesting choice there as this class is ending.
As I alluded to earlier, I think it's too obvious with what it's referencing. I mean, they don't. You could have had fun with people, or maybe Craven didn't want to do this. Someone should have argued Dream Warriors as the better Nightmare movie.
Oh, he Craven wouldn't do that.
But, or, someone be The Exorcist 3. That nowadays, that's more beloved and has much more of a following than it did in 1997. I just think for a film class where all these people seem pretty knowledgeable, it's not people falling asleep in class. Like, these seem like actual film buffs. They should be a lot more niched and passionate with their choices than the ones that a casual moviegoer would say.
But you know what? Me and a third on this podcast have had these discussions a lot, so it was interesting seeing them played out once again. As much as we're
And for the record, also, they're wrong about Terminator 2.
Yeah, we
Since we
discussed
had that
that.
argument.
We discussed that when we did Predator. I just edited that goddamn show. Adam, you and I have had these discussions a lot. What do you think about seeing this play out in this scene?
First of all, seeing Shoemaker here blew me away because, oh my God, that took me. I'm the love doctor, baby. Like, holy crap, that took me back. I mean, one, this entire scene looks like they just went over to what at that point, I guess it was UPN and was like, hey, who's available to come over? I mean, you got Dawson showing up like in an uncredited fucking just like sitting here in the seats.
Matthew Lillard's here somewhere, too.
I mean, yeah, he's back by the end of the series as well, it appears. I dig the scene, other than because I know all of these people, it's distracting to watch. But I'm cool with this discussion. It is so obvious that Timothy Olyphantastic was going to be the killer that there's no way that was originally planned. Mm-hmm. Because it is so obvious you're not going to do that again. It's kind of like Billy in the first one. He's so obvious that he can't be the killer. So of course he is the killer. You're not playing that beat twice. And it's a shame that we end up going there with it. But I kind of like everybody here, though. Before somebody yells, you get a big scene with Sarah Michelle Gellar about halfway through this film. You get one big scene with her when she's at the sorority house. So she shows up a little bit later, but she's basically all by herself in that scene as well.
Yeah, we'll get to that scene. I have things to say.
Yeah, and but she shot this the same year as I Know What You Did Last Summer, which is so hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was absolutely blown away by. Jesus criminy, I guess. You know, everybody else from Seventh Heaven wasn't available to come on as well.
She obviously didn't read this script. She didn't have time to.
Well, this one also lucked out. Unlike the first one where Skeet Ulrich and Matthew Lillard and Jamie Kennedy, they've had solid, like they've worked consistently. But this one, they lucked out as far as like Sarah Michelle Gellar, Buffy was on the rise. Timothy Olyphant's gone on to be a great TV star, you know, with Deadwood, Justified. You know, even Jerry O'Connell, talk about in a bit, went on to, I mean, look, he married way above his level. So you're set for life, man.
Yeah.
And also, like, even Liev Schreiber, who's a cameo in the first one, you know, he'd go on to be a bigger star. So this one at least benefited from, you can see much more potential in the supporting cast down the road.
Gellar and O'Connell actually started dating right after this one. Was done. O'Connell got around, man. Good for him.
Yeah, and then she married Freddie Prinze Jr. Mm-hmm.
So Randy says that he'd like to see the geek get the girl as he leaves the class with Sydney. Sydney is starting to freak out over the murders from the night before as her new boyfriend, Derek, played by Jerry O'Connell, the aforementioned Jerry O'Connell, comes to rescue her. Now, boys, we'll be talking about him again soon and when we finally get to Stand By Me. It was fun seeing him here, even though he just always plays, especially at this point, Adam, he was always just playing the slicked out frat boys, right? The himbo that just couldn't get away, right?
Crazy, because I still haven't seen Stand By Me, so chastise me for that when we get to it. I can't believe that JJ didn't try to get him in a Superman movie, because you look at just the way that he presents himself out there. I'm like, yeah, he's Superman by look and face and everything else. He's, I mean, tie a sweater around his neck and he is your villain in any 80s college movie, you know, but it's weird. Like, he's got a presence, and I didn't remember Jerry O'Connell in this film. And hey, look, he likes his salad the same way that I do, with romaine. And you know, he's
what is up with you guys today?
He's a pretty good presence here. I forgot he was here, and I think he's better than I remember him in most things, because I usually find him utterly forgettable.
Well, he always played like a, after this, he played the snarky, sometimes nebbish to a fault type of characters where you just want to slap them. But here he is sort of that all-American, you know, I'm surprised he's not a football player. How he's written.
We'll see him with Jerry. He was with Jerry Maguire the year before, right?
Maybe that's why.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Because I get the sense he was supposed to be a jock, like a full-blown jock, because he's in a fraternity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Might as well give him the trifecta of having him be like an athlete. But I like him much more than I thought I would as sort of the genuinely nice boyfriend. But all I see is freaking, to your point on Superman, he did play him technically.
Yeah. Yep.
With voice work for like a decade, but I feel like Brendan Fraser took all of the roles that he could have gotten. Like, you look at The Mummy, you look at Gods and Monsters and Quiet American, where Brendan Fraser showed he could really act. I feel like those are the roles Jerry O'Connell could have gotten if he was a little bit more talented.
We cut to Gail, still going after the story and getting a new cameraman named Joel, and she's being visited by Debbie Salt, played by Roseanne's own Laurie Metcalf.
And you should also mention, I wonder if in the interview process, if Gail had to disclose that her previous cameraman was murdered.
I know, right? This guy gets spooked out pretty quick, though. He's a little smarter than last week. She says that she can't wait to see the movie as she asks what her position on the violence in movies is going to be, and Gail is now being questioned. Again, bringing up this violence in movies. The chief is being questioned by Gail, who's asking about precautions and the fact that this is an isolated incident. And Randy is freaking out that Gale Weathers is here, and Sydney is quick to point out that she saved our lives before. And we then see, you know what? I gotta say, guys, the first time I watched this movie, I knew the killers of this were Portia de Rossi and Rebecca Gayheart. That was who I had handpicked to actually be the killers, and of course that's not true, but here they are. They're sorority chicks. They're here to taunt Sydney a bit as Sydney spots Dewey. Adam, did you think these two had any possibility of being the killers?
Absolutely, and save that for Rebecca Gayheart and something else.
Yeah, a couple years later.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of meant to be, but yeah, I absolutely believe that's where this was going. It's funny because of two people that, you know, I'll say Gayheart never does anything for me. Even her hair is just she wishes she was Noxzema Girl. But Portia de Rossi does some really good work on Ally McBeal here. It's funny that they're probably the youngest ones, but they feel older than everybody else in this film.
Matt, did you think there was any way these chicks were the fucking killers in this?
See, this gets into a problem I have with this movie in general. I'm nowhere near as interested in trying to deduce who the killer is compared to the first one.
All right, so we're getting the Dewey theme here. Interesting story about this theme is Marco Beltrami, who is a composer they actually, speaking of the internet, they got off the internet. For some reason, they decided to take the theme from Broken Arrow, one of Adam's favorite movies, and enter it as the Dewey theme. The music in this is weird, and I have a big problem with the music, and I'm mentioning that right now. We talked about all the series before, Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. They all have memorable themes. This has no memorable themes, and that's a big problem I have with the Scream series, is the music is utterly forgettable. It just gets the action going. Adam, as the fellow film music lover on this podcast, what do you think about that? Is the fact that there's no fucking horror theme a problem for you?
No, because other than a few movies when it comes to horror, I don't think of it that way. Like, I want individual themes, but I usually don't think of it with a movie. A score, I guess, would be the better way to think about it. Like, I don't consider a horror movie score to be anything important to me. Themes, yeah, but this doesn't have much of that either.
I think the thing you were starting to notice around this time, they were shifting away from scores and focusing more on soundtracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Especially in the 90s. Yep.
Yeah, and compilations, getting artists to do exclusive songs.
Good point.
As tie-ins. It's not so much in this one. There's a couple. But once you get to three, they're much more into the, we're trying to sell music as much as we're trying to sell the movie.
Mm-hmm. That's why every studio has a music division.
Because this one you had, like, people that were popular at the time, like Sugar Ray. Don't understand why they were ever popular. Speaking of which, Mark McGrath looked like Ethan Hawke's long-lost brother. I don't know if you've ever seen him lately. Dave Matthews Band is on this. Everclear.
Everclear, yeah. I remember doing inventory.
We did not mention this in last week's show, though, when we should, the Nick Cave song.
Yeah, and I love that song.
Yeah, I remember we did inventory at the video store at the end of this year, and my boss had actually played this soundtrack as we were doing that inventory. That's why a lot of these themes resonate with me. So speaking of the Dewey theme, we have Dewey here. He says that he's worried about Sydney. Matt, what do you feel about actually seeing Dewey again?
I appreciate the canon that they actually, pardon the pun, they run with him having a bum leg.
I like that too.
Because a lot of sequels, they'll forget about like people having legit injuries.
Yeah.
Almost like they never happened. So I like that someone actually, you have Sydney who's living with the mental stress. Dewey has the physical ramifications of now he's got to limp for the rest of his life.
Now, Adam, as the person on this podcast who not only hates Quint, but also hated Dewey last week, what did you think about seeing him back here?
I think they do some good stuff with him here. I think he's more believable, but I could not believe how much when he shows up, I'm worried for David Arquette. I mean, did he go to Matthew Perry's freaking personal doctor? Because he looks coked out in this film. Dude weighs less than Courtney Cox. I mean, he looks unhealthy through this thing.
He was staying up late watching Nitro as he was doing this stuff.
save that for next week.
Yeah.
But I do like him. I think he actually does considerably better in this film, and I like the way where they go with them, but I think they also completely change things and pull punches by the end of this film due to what they have with them.
It's also surprising they brought him back, because you figured of everyone he'd be the most, you could justify leaving him behind the most.
Mm-hmm.
Sydney says that she's okay as theater's going well, and she's actually seeing someone now, and Dewey says that
this I don't like, for the record. I don't like the whole thing of Sydney trying to become an actress and
Yeah.
being super into theater, because that was never really established as an aspect of her character in the last one. So it feels really forced and only here to service the staging of the climax.
I agree with that. They try explaining it away by saying this is a way, it's like a cathartic experience for her to kind of make her forget about what happened last week. But you're absolutely right. It literally comes out of nowhere because there was nothing said last week that made us even think that she was interested in the arts.
And also,
No.
if you want some kind of creative outlet, that's why therapy
That's
exists.
very true.
Therapy schmerapy. I'm kidding, people.
Yeah,
Please go
as
for it
somebody who's
because I
going
can't.
through it, God damn it.
Yeah, you got two people on this airwave who are seeing people on a
Yes.
consistent
I know.
basis.
And somebody who really should, from what I can handle. I do think that having her do this, I think this is screenwriting douchebaggery. I think this is Quentin Tarantino, just a style of, oh, the movies are so fucking important, and an actress and a screenwriter is so fucking important, and acting is therapy. Like, that's how it comes across to me. Because not only would she not do it, but her teacher for it, with long lost, great actor, and he'll always be Sark to me from Tron, but he puts her in some utterly shitty positions for what she's gone through.
So Dewey says that he's worried someone is following in the previous killer's footsteps, and he wants her to be careful. Sydney says that she doesn't want to cut anyone out, but Dewey tells her to keep an eye out. He also says that he's going to hang around to make sure she's safe. So again, we're kind of painting Dewey as a suspect here, right?
It's to an extent, but it's always the problem of if you find out that the cripple, the leg is like a, it's he's faking it. That would have been borderline nonsensical if that was the reveal.
Yeah.
And that would have been one where, okay, this doesn't track at all if you made him the killer. So I think I would not have just said it. I would not have made him a suspect whatsoever, especially because this one, unlike the first one, there's too many characters.
Way too many.
I was trying to remember because it's clear that they're trying to. I mean, everybody is a red herring. I mean, you might as well call this Red Herring the movie, but I was
Why?
trying to remember.
Because you have Daphne in this?
Well, that's true. I was thinking, did they literally Usual Suspects this movie? Because I could not remember. And I thought the entire time, I thought that the limp was fake.
Well, technically, the first Scary Movie does that, where he, the David Arquette stand-in, they rip off the end of Usual Suspects.
Mickey says the girl was from last night was stabbed 7 times as Gail shows up with Cotton for a reunion with Sydney, who calls Gail a bitch and once again slaps her down and leaves. So Cotton here is being painted as somebody who just wants the 15 minutes of fame. Matt, what do you think about this direction of this character?
Well, before I get to that, I like it. I dislike how Gail is portrayed in this movie because they soften her up much more than in the first one, but she still pulls this like Maury Povich, Jerry Springer type of shock
Yeah.
media. So when she sort of turns later on in the movie, I don't 100% believe it.
It's funny because the way that I see Gail and the way that I see her reacting and showing up, it just takes me to Die Hard, especially when he shows back up in Die Hard 2. And you're just like, how do you get the reporter coming back? Just
Yeah.
cause. But I like that it changes up a little bit. I'm good with all this, though. I can't help but and it I can't believe I'm laughing at these jokes about that's my head on Jennifer Aniston's body. Like,
Yeah.
I'm better than laughing at that joke, but I guess I'm not because it did make me laugh.
You know what, though? We talked about it last week, but it has to be brought up again. This was the thing to do in the 90s. OJ was fresh on everybody's mind. You get that 15 minutes of fame of being falsely accused and get off.
I do think that's something that is lost watching this 30 years later. 28, God dang, we're old. Is Donahue, Sally Jesse Raphael, not even Jerry Springer,
Jenny Jones.
but yeah, just, I mean, those type of shows were it, and you would get it. I mean, OJ was, what, 2 years before this? So, I mean, the case would have been just going. So it's that kind of thing where it's tough to translate it today, but it does make sense for the time.
Cotton is confused as he was promised 10 minutes and that he feels like he did his part. And I'll say, we talked about there's way too many characters here, but I'm liking the reintroduction to the characters that we saw before. Matt, do you have any issues with how they handle Sydney, how they handle Gail, how they handle even Cotton and Dewey? Do you have any issues with how everybody's getting reintroduced here?
Well, Gail, I've already spoken my piece on.
Yeah.
I don't think that 100% works. Sydney, I have that problem with her desire to do theater as catharsis. And also, we haven't mentioned him. Randy kind of gets the shaft of this one.
Yeah, he does.
He's
literally,
but for a returning character, he's very much in the background until they're like, it's almost like they forgot he was in the, he was on set, and they're like, oh shit, we forgot. Oh my God, we forgot Meg. It's that level of amnesiac writing where some, I even think they forgot he was in the movie. So I like Hollywood. That the returning characters are back, but almost all of them, I have issues with how they're, I mean, right down to Dewey being here just feels like contractual obligation.
It's funny because I didn't think of it till just now, but Nightmare 4, anybody? But no, I like the way that everybody comes back. And for the most part, I like the way even the new characters are done. I was not expecting to be into this movie as much as I am. Once we get here, once we got past that, what I found was a very bad opening. I'm in. It's actually got me wondering what's going on. I'm digging the people. I'm for this. This movie's got me gripped. What it was is that when we got the, when they brought Sydney back, she answers the phone and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe we're fucking doing that. No, she's learned. She's grown. She's strong. She's got a caller ID. So they've addressed issues that would have come up, you know, just naturally. And I like that she's not a damsel as much as she kind of was in the first one. She's grown. And I fucking like that.
Dewey tells Gale to leave Sydney alone as he reenacts descriptions that Gale gave of him in her book. I don't know, Adam, I still find these two to be pretty sweet together. You didn't really like the chemistry between them last time. How do you feel about them this time?
Yeah, I feel like he did the same thing when they went to their divorce lawyer. I like them here. This is when I actually feel, I didn't get the romance part from the first time, but I feel like these two actually enjoy each other, and I like the way they play off each other.
Dewey ends this by saying, if you'll excuse me, I have some oozing to do before telling her nice face, which I don't know why I laughed my ass off when I saw that. We cut to the party with Hallie and Sydney as we once again see Portia de Rossi and Rebecca Gayheart kind of hanging around. And then we cut back to Cece, played by Buffy herself, as she's being called by the killer. She thinks it's Ted, her boyfriend, but it becomes apparent that it's not. There's a little back and forth until he asks if she wants to die tonight. She's told the movie Stab is bringing out the crazies as there's movement upstairs. And we have a little Friday the 13th theme being played by the woman on the other line as she walks outside, and it's suggested to Cece that she call campus security. They hang up as Donna, her roommate, shows up behind her. Donna answers the phone and she's told that it's Ted. Once Cece gets the phone, she's told to once again set the alarm. She walks through the house and we get the doors opening and no one being there bit for a little while until her phone rings yet again. Cece picks it up and is attacked. She, of course, runs up the stairs and hits Ghostface with a plant until she's caught up with and stabbed a few times in the background and then thrown off a roof. All right, guys. I'm sorry.
That's all I can think of is Buffy would never.
Yeah, no shit. I have so many issues with this. A, I think this is very uninteresting. I think this is a very poorly staged kill. This is not Ghostface MO of throwing her off a goddamn roof. I don't even know if this is Mrs. Loomis or if this is Mickey doing this. This is all just thrown in here because we need a kill. And it's really, you do Buffy like this, it'll get me every time. I fucking hate this kill.
I'm in lockstep with you. And also, unlike the first one, this sequence is poorly blocked.
Yes.
Like, I get this. Did they forget? Like, that bike should not be there. And to the point where Scary Movie did this better. When they throw the bike there, it's actually supposed to be funny that there's objects. This one, it makes no sense. And this sorority house, at times, it's the size of the Playboy Mansion. And at other times, it feels like it's the size of a shack in the woods. And I also think it's, the suspense is nowhere near as interesting because of the cutoff intention when the roommate comes back. You immediately de-escalate the scene, and then you try to build it back up again, and it doesn't work.
I like this scene quite a bit.
Oh my God, no.
I did not like the way that it started, because if you're going to rehash it, do a little something different. But I was glad. I was glad to see it, and I don't like Sarah Michelle Gellar.
So that explains it.
But I mean, kind of period. I don't like her as a person. I don't like her as an actress. I think this is about as good as she gives. I like the way it's done. I like that they change up what we got a little bit. I like when I don't know what door Ghostface is going to be behind, because I think it's going to be just simple as it could be, but it's not. And at least they change it up a little bit. I like that she's fucking yeeted off a balcony for a reason that I don't understand, though that fall is not big enough to kill her.
Yes,
do I agree?
That also.
it's a second story. I've jumped off a second story, folks. I do agree that the house makes no sense. I do laugh at the bike because, to Matt's point, I saw the gag coming. But I actually liked this quite a bit. And I do think to have a face you know, that I recognized to be taken out of this film, I wasn't necessarily expecting it. So I dug this.
But don't you feel that's a retread of Drew Barrymore, where you're killing off your biggest name, and it doesn't have that same effect?
Yes.
I also have the problem, we didn't talk about this, the first one, makes sense that Billy and Stu would know Casey's house, mm-hmm. because they know her, it's a small town. How do Mickey and or Mrs. Loomis get the layout of the sorority house? Not like he was dating her. Like, this is the problem with the whodunit, where this one, unlike the first one, there's a lot more leaps in logic.
We go back to the sorority party as Sydney is just bored out of her mind. Mickey and Randy, they argue about Empire Strikes Back until Derek shows up, which I actually kind of laughed.
Yeah, I hate how this turns into a Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah, it does. Good point. And Adam's laughing his ass off at this.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
Well, just like, that's the obvious one. I'm sorry, Terminator 2 is not better than Terminator. Aliens is not better than Alien. I mean, there's plenty of options.
Oh, boy. You got the one who gave the 10 out of 10 to Aliens on this podcast. Hey,
one's a 10 out of 10, one's a 9 out of 10. But I like that what they are explaining is what this movie does. When they discuss the escalation, when they discuss about the rules of sequels, this movie does hit those. And much like the first one, it's doing it as a meta piece about it. So I like it. I think it fits. But it reminds you that these movies are pretty much spoofs.
I love how Matt was pipe. I heard him getting ready to pipe up as soon as you said
that. Oh, he was ready to punch me through the screen.
Yeah, he was. We hear that police are everywhere, and then we see Debbie Salt, who we'll know as Mrs. Loomis. She's trying to get the story, as Gail is scared that she's going to get scooped.
This movie also has the problem. They talk a lot about security and cops when it's convenient.
Yep.
Joel, the cameraman, is starting to have second thoughts as Sydney continues getting calls. She sees Derek on the outside as she answers the phone, and it's Ghostface asking if she remembers him. When she asks to show his face, he's right there. And then we see a knife go through a door as she's chased some more, and there's Derek. Dewey shows up and sees Derek on the floor. The sorority girls are there, and we see that Derek has been cut. So we're throwing the red herring back at the audience, aren't we?
We are, and I think you need it, and I think you expect it, but much the way that Dewey says, you know, everything is convenient in the way that it's done, so you don't really know. And I think it's kind of obvious at this point in the screenwriting, they didn't really know either.
So Dewey tends to Derek, and we see that Sydney has just had it with everything. She just wants out of this. We see that everyone at the police station is being questioned, including Mickey, as Sydney says that she knew that this was coming and that this wasn't over yet. Mickey says that people need to realize that the 90s is no time to be a hero. No shit. Because you had the Phantom come out the year before.
Because Beyond Thunderdome and that Tina Turner song came out in the 80s.
Yeah, but this is the same year as Batman and Robin. So no. This was no time to be a hero. Derek is told that he's lucky there's no nerve damage, and Dewey says that it's convenient that Derek is cut and that the killer got away so easily. We see the school is once again surrounded by reporters, and Gail and Dewey and the chief go over who's been killed and what they're doing to keep Sydney safe. And we see that detectives are now following Sydney around, and Sydney says that she doesn't want to see Derek being hurt again. So, Adam, we are kind of upping the stakes here by keeping detectives around Sydney, right?
Yeah, and I think it's a smart move. I mean, you would do this at this point, but it's amazing how we keep getting told all the officers are on this case, but we see like 2, 4 for a college town. This is the most inept security that we got. You need to escalate it, and you feel like somebody's there to protect her, and you got to get cannon fodder because you do need to up the body stakes.
Yeah, as Randy will tell us later on.
Body count's got to go up.
Matt, what'd you think about this? You just mentioned that police are here only when it's convenient. Is that how you're feeling here?
Yeah, because they set it up well. Makes all the sense in the world that she would have extra protection. I mean, she should have hired the APA. But then there are other times where I guess the city ran out of money and they told the cops to go home.
See, but what I like while this is going on, Sydney's not scared. Like, this isn't done because she's your standard horror movie trope, and I do like that change.
Well, she's never been that trope. That's why I like her so much. Last week I mentioned that, you know, she's calling out the fact that it's dumb blondes running upstairs so that they get trapped. Well, that's exactly what she did, not realizing it. And that's mm-hmm. why I like her in this role. That's why I like this character so much, at least in these first few films. I don't know what we're going to get in the next coming weeks, but I like her because of that.
Yeah, I guess I don't mean a change in her and a change in the way that this type of character is utilized normally. But yeah, I think it's a really good way that it's done.
Sydney says that she's concerned for Dewey's well-being, but not the fact that she's discounted him as a suspect. And boy, they wouldn't play this card of her boyfriend being the killer again, would they, guys? We see Dewey exit the police station, and he says that he's here to help Sydney. Gail says that she's here to help too, and Dewey says that he won't smile until the killer is caught. Gail is pursued by Debbie Salt, and once again, she won't give her anything to go on, and Mickey says that he actually thinks it's Randy who is doing the killing. Boy, you guys are absolutely right. Randy gets the absolute shaft in this fucking movie. This is the first time he's mentioned in at least a half hour.
Yeah. Those Sydney. Poor video store guys.
Sydney talks about the profiles of the detectives following her as Derek serenades her Top Gun style. This was fucking cringy, man. I forgot about this, and my God, did I fucking... I cringed for him watching this.
Yeah, this is like when they asked Pierce Brosnan to sing in Mamma Mia. He just wanted to jab pencils into your ears. Oh boy, this is like, if this was the 80s, you could have gotten away with that. In the 90s, he would have serenaded her with some Nirvana or Nine Inch Nails.
Love how horrible and cheesy this is, though. Because it, I mean... Look, you do what you got to do when somebody's out of your league. And not only is Sydney out of his league, but this had to be how he got Rebecca. I mean, you know, and they call it out. He's doing a Top Gun. This made me laugh so hard because it doesn't just start. It keeps fucking going. Like, he does the whole bit. Oh, man, I was a choir guy in high school and I wouldn't have pulled this off.
Somebody on this podcast actually made a request on a radio to send it to somebody by name. Remember that, Adam? Remember when I did that?
Mm-hmm.
And they did it, and I recorded it, and I gave it to her, and she still dumped me. So Derek puts a necklace on Sydney and gets a standing ovation. We then see Tori Spelling being interviewed by Nancy O'Dell as the clip is being played with her and Luke Wilson as the Skeet Ulrich character from last week. You know what? I gotta say, up until this movie, I had no idea that Tori Spelling had a sense of humor, but here we have it. And Luke Wilson is a little bit of an improvement over Skeet Ulrich.
Well, I'm distracted because Luke Wilson looks more like David Arquette than he does.
He really does. Yeah, that's a good point.
But that kind of kept throwing me off. But I like that they're continuing the thing of casting like actor stand-ins in the same way that you would get people to play like Jeffrey Dahmer in the 90s on some TV show.
Well, if you recall, last week, Sydney was the one who said, oh, with my luck, it'll be Tori Spelling. Well, here she is. I don't know, man. Good for her.
I forgot about that.
Actually, yep. Good for her actually having a sense of humor and saying, yeah, I'll do that. I remember that.
Good when you reference it to the first movie. It's bad when you reference it to, not to piss Garrett off again, she joins the Scary Movie franchise. So it's hard to, I mean, she plays both sides of the fence, and good for her.
Randy is talking to Dewey about the rules of sequels, such as the body count always has to be bigger. There always has to be more blood. We have what he calls carnage candy. And then he goes over who the suspects are. And Randy says that the killer wants to break new ground, and he names Mickey. And if Mickey is named, Randy has to be one too, as does Dewey. He also names Gail Weathers, who's an opportunist. And then Randy points out his scars, and Dewey has a limp from last time. All right, so here's the big speech for this film. We talked about last week's speech having kind of an impact on us. Adam, how do you feel about how Randy outlines sequels here?
It made for a good trailer.
Yeah.
That's kind of what this, is for. It does its job. The same way that it set up the rules in the first one, it gives you the rules of a sequel. We're a little beyond this, but if you're coming into this as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, this makes sense, and you're popping for this like you are the horror rules in part one.
At least the rules that they're choosing are tried and true, and there's nothing that makes me go, that doesn't make any sense for the meta angle, but I will also say one of the things that does also hurt it, and I don't think we mentioned this, is that when Scream did that, it felt fresh, and we were still getting, like, horror was in a different place. Now, we are very removed from, like, horror sequels being really popular, to the point where, like, Halloween 6 nobody saw, and freaking Hellraiser went to video because people stopped caring. So it doesn't have the oomph or the impact that the first one did in that regard as well.
Dewey says that Gail isn't a killer, and Randy replies, if she's not the killer, she's a target. Meanwhile, Joel, the cameraman, he goes over what happened to Gale's last cameraman, and he's convinced.
Oh, I'm glad they finally.
I did too.
I made that joke. I was like, okay, that's actually, that might be my favorite end joke in the movie as far as continuity.
Mine too. And I even like when he goes, brothers don't last long in these things, and he needs to go. I like that he calls both those things out. Gale replies that she can't do this without him, and they leave to pursue the story. We see Sydney talking to her teacher, David Warner. My God, I forgot he was in this.
Fucking weird.
Yeah, that was odd seeing him here. Remember, he had actually, didn't he rehearse, or didn't he audition to be Freddy way back?
Yeah, well, he was originally cast.
That's right, he was cast.
He was Freddy.
But look, this is a man who there is no property he will say no to. This is the guy who was in Tron.
Yes.
He did every version of Star Trek that they asked him to do. He did Ninja Turtles 2.
That's right, yeah.
He was in a lot of John Carpenter's, some of his movies. Mm-hmm. He was a great Ra's al Ghul in voiceover work. It's just weird seeing him in this, of all things, because I'm like, what student would want to be his pupil? Because he comes off as like, he's that teacher that that strict teacher that nobody would want.
Rest in peace, sir, but it was just really odd seeing him here.
Like, he should have been like how the students respond to Snape in Harry Potter, where nobody likes him and he just hates everybody in return.
He tells Sydney that this is her role that she needs to pursue, as her strength of what she went through will help her embrace the power that the role will give her. And to your guys' point, it's just lame having her be this cathartic theater student. We're seeing the play being rehearsed with Sydney in the lead role. And as she's rehearsing, she sees somebody who she thinks is wearing a ghost face mask, and she goes down. So did she or didn't she? I kind of wish Williamson and Craven could have played with this a little bit more.
Yeah. Is it in her mind? Is it not? I just have a problem with this being done. I understand what they're saying with it. I just don't like that they're choosing to do it.
Well, this would have been the perfect way to riff on Nightmare on Elm Street, with the idea of her like not being able to sleep and maybe she's hallucinating. Like, you could have had a lot of fun with that. And that would have been really appropriate for Craven to kind of be like, well, here's my version of Nightmare on Elm Street.
I was going to say, of all people, why wouldn't Craven do that?
I think he was still butthurt about what happened to that franchise. Damn. Even though he got to make his, you know,
ultimate version that made $2.
Yeah, it made $2 and looked like, you know, and a Snickers bar has more nutritional value than that movie.
You'd be disgusted. Red Adam's getting ready to explode. Derek shows up to pick Sydney up, and Derek says that being alone isn't the answer, and she replies that she just needs some distance.
It's the 90s. They were chock full of loner movies, especially high school movies were all about loneliness.
And I love how he's just like, don't I have a say in this? No, asshole, you don't have a say in this if she wants some distance. Adam, how'd you feel about this breakup, sir?
Give me my necklace back.
Yeah, right?
Give me my letters back. Give me my ring back, Lisa. Mm-hmm. Give me my jacket back, for example.
Derek relinquishes reluctantly, and then he leaves. Cut to Dewey, Randy, and Gale as Gale is upset. As Adam mentioned, that there were naked pictures featuring her head and Jennifer Aniston's body.
I love that not only this, but they get a David Schwimmer joke.
Oh, yeah. Too. Joel, the cameraman, says that he's going to leave, and he wants her to come back when they talk about something a little more Saved by the Bell-ish. The killer then calls Randy, who knows that it's him. He says that the killer can see them, and Dewey tells him to keep the killer on the phone as he searches for him. Randy asks, what's up? And he says, perhaps the most 90s line of this movie, that his favorite scary movie is Showgirls. Now,
the only person they didn't get in this cast, Elizabeth Berkley.
Low blow. Well,
that movie killed her career, basically.
Pretty much. Randy is bumped by someone trying to catch a football as Gale is convinced that they're being played with. Randy is told that he'll never be the leading man and he'll never be the hero. The pursuit is on as randoms on phones are stopped and Randy makes fun of Debbie Salt, which I found funny. He's then pulled into a van and you know what, guys? I have to be honest. It's been forever since I've seen this movie. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I forgot that Randy died here, so this kind of got me.
Well, it's just easy to forget, given how if you've seen three, you forget that he died, and I could see how that would mess with your psyche. I would have been more surprised if he was in the movie more. And I feel like this whole thing of doing it in broad daylight with everyone watching, that part is kind of scary, but it's kind of ruined by how dated the whole thing of trying to track the phone is. Which I know there's nothing you could do about that at the time, but it kind of makes it more hackers holds up better than this.
Oh, jeez.
Man, not Randy. That's exactly what I wrote down. I was like, damn it, Randy, no. This got me. I think it's a good kill. I think it's a good grab, you know, other than the, you know, again, another trailer line. Showgirls. It's a good death. Again, he delivered what he said. You're going to up the gore, up the violence, up the slashes. And yeah, it works. That it's in broad daylight, right, with everybody there, kind of in the quad. It's a good kill. I like this.
Did they up the gore, though? Last week, we had entrails falling out. We had people being gutted.
No, they don't have that.
This feels more tame to me for some reason.
Yeah, if you told me this movie was PG-13, I would have honestly believed you.
Same.
I feel like the blood is, to your point, yeah. I mean, the entrails, which we got twice in the opening, you know, was pretty damn horrific. But then the rest of it was pretty tame, I felt. I think this at least has got your blood squirting everywhere. You got pools of blood that we have going on.
I don't know, man. That whole house was covered in blood in last week's film. Blood is falling from the van as we see the killer exit. So this, of course, would make Joel the cameraman the lead suspect in some people's eyes. We then go to the library as Sydney's computer freezes. She sees the message that you're going to die tonight and the police can't save you. She's told to wait as the detectives spring to life and investigate, and Cotton catches up to Sydney, so they couldn't catch him. Jesus Christ. He says that he has a solution to their problems, and he says that Diane Sawyer has called and says that she will make them the entire hour, which would give them $10,000 each.
It's just funny because you hear that now and it's just like, okay, and? You got to remember this is the 90s, and yeah, big deal. Mm-hmm. But it's just like those lines don't play today.
Sydney says that they need to get on with their lives, and Cotton is upset that his name is being dragged through the mud. He's then apprehended, and Cotton says that he's not Billy Loomis. He's being dragged away. We see Cotton being interrogated, and Dewey tells Sydney about Randy. She says to not treat her like glass because she's not going to break. Cotton reinforces that he's an innocent man, and the chief has no choice but to let him go. He signs his way out as Gail appears. She asks what he's doing and then warns him to not do anything stupid. So at this point, it's either Joel the cameraman or Cotton, right, Matt? We're trying to kind of throw red herrings here.
Well, there you get the sense that these writers, I mean, part of this was true. They might have written like a choose-your-own-adventure where every single side character was the killer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question was, okay, how do we explain it? And they said, we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
And I do think that you figured this movie came out a year later. So not written, huh?
Not even. Like less than a year later.
Yeah, less than a year. So you got to figure, you got to re-sign the deals. You got to get a script. You got to get production into progress. You got to get it shot, edited, done, and out. And yeah, there's no way that this started shooting and they knew how it was ending. So a lot of this had to be everybody's a possibility and we'll figure it out as we go.
By the way, I'm glad you mentioned that because as somebody who did this job, I got to give kudos to the producers here because I'd say about 90 to 95% of this cast all had TV shows going at the time. You had to coordinate this around their schedules because as Adam mentioned, it's all UPN and NBC people here. It's crazy that they were able to get this cast in the same place at the same time for these scenes, except for Sarah Michelle Gellar, who they filmed separately. But Adam, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Yes. And you don't see that much nowadays, and you normally don't even have contracts that would allow them to go do this kind of thing anymore. So kudos to them.
Sydney is confused as she doesn't know who could be doing this if it isn't Cotton. We didn't see Debbie Salt. She shows up again and asks how Gail is holding up, and Gail tells her to just give it a rest. Joel, the cameraman, drops off the footage and leaves, saying, "See you, wouldn't want to be you." Another fucking just complete 80s reference. 90s. Gail says that she feels bad, and that's weird because she doesn't feel bad about anything. Dewey asks if this is another brilliant Gail Weathers performance, and Gail says that there aren't any cameras here. She really wants to find this fucker. Dewey then grabs the footage that Joel shot, and Gail is convinced that the killer will be on the tapes. So they decide to go check them out together. We cut to inside the university editing room as Dewey commits breaking and entering to get there. They bump heads as she grabs the tape, and then they go through the footage as well as the meeting that we saw between them earlier. And Gail says that he's cute when he's angry. And then she says that she never meant to hurt him. And they kiss, and then they really start going at it as she spots footage of each death and then live footage of each other. Adam, how'd you feel about this editing scene?
It gets where we need to be. I don't understand how we suddenly go from them watching a video to the live footage, but I get past it. I feel like I'm watching these two literally become a couple in this movie. So that real life scenario, I can't not know it. But I like the way that it's done. I like the appearance here at the end when it does turn to live, when Ghost shows up, Ghostface shows up. I like the way that this happens.
Yeah, I do too. I actually think in a little bit, this sequence actually gets surprisingly creative.
This causes Dewey to pursue the killer as he appears behind Gale. Chase is on as she goes through the building. She goes inside one room as she sees Ghostface inside. We have a little game of cat and mouse as Gale is hiding behind walls until she locks herself in a file room. Dewey comes in as the Dewey theme plays. He sees her through the glass and he's stepping on wires as Ghostface shows up behind him. And once again, we think that this is the end of Dewey. And as you mentioned, Matt, I think this is pretty awesome as Gale just kind of sees it from her end of the glass and blood moving down. This would have been a pretty great end if they were to decide to kill him here.
You certainly would have had that option, but I also like they do with in the soundproof room.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually pretty inventive for a movie like this. I wish the rest of the movie was that well thought out. Or different, because one of the things I also don't like about this movie, I'm never scared or like shocked when Ghostface shows up compared to the first one.
I liked it quite a bit. And to Matt's point, using that soundproof room, I like that choice. It brings something different to it, and I think it's inventive. I also think Courtney Cox gives a good performance. Like, she's doing something that we're not used to seeing, and I think it shows that she actually has some acting ability. Not something I can say from seeing her on a lot of things other than being a comedian. I think it's one of the better things that she's done is actually in this movie, crazy as that is.
Oh god, didn't you see her handle the cosmic key in Masters of the Universe? Oh wait, maybe we'll discuss that one day.
I mean, that was the best. So let's Will Doerr approve.
We see Ghostface try to break the glass and Gale just kind of cower in horror until everything just kind of stops. And another shot from the trailer, right, Adam? Her just screaming at that whole situation, what made the trailers as well.
Absolutely. The trailer for this one's cut really well because it basically, the trailer is what the film is. Everybody's a suspect and you'll find out at the end.
We see Derek show up again as Sydney is led out by detectives, and she leaves with Hallie, making her reappearance into the fucking movie. What is it, an hour and 10 minutes later?
Remember her?
God damn.
The editor didn't.
We cut to someone running behind Derek, and then he's carried off by sorority assholes. I thought this was actually kind of clever, because we're seeing someone with a cape, someone with a hood running behind him. We're thinking, oh shit, he's dead. Oh no, it's just a college sorority coming to pick him up. Now, the fact he ends up where he ends up, I'm not too happy about that. But I thought, again, we have some creativity going on here.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to involve like character displacement, this is a good way to kind of handle that.
So we see Derek strung up and prodded at. And then we see the car that Sydney and Hallie are in stop at a red light as the detectives are kicked and sliced open, just beat to shit. Hallie can't open the door as one of the cops hangs on the hood until he's completely smashed to death. Hallie questions whether Ghostface is dead, and Sydney says that he's still breathing. Sydney breaks the cage separating them, and my god, this scene is just too goddamn long.
It's long, but damn, this is an intense scene. I like these kills are... I like this quite a bit. I mean, you got two agents here that are just utterly destroyed. I don't understand how they get their ass kicked that easy, but it is what it is. I like all of this. All the way to them, how they got to get out of the car and the way that that's done and the tension of Ghostface being knocked out in the front. Like, no, I like this.
Wow.
I wish somebody yelled cut.
Yeah, me and Matt we're lockstep with this. They finally escape and Sydney just wants to go back. As Hallie says, only dumb people go back after they've escaped. But she goes back and sees that Ghostface is gone. She then sees Hallie sliced to shreds. So there goes her being a suspect. Cotton appears in front of Gale with bloody hands, and he says that he just tried helping Dewey. Gale takes the payphone from Debbie Salt and says that the killer is Cotton Weary. We then cut to inside the theater. Oh, God. As Sydney runs in.
And here's where the movie takes a nosedive.
You're not kidding. As Sydney runs in and hollers for help, the production is seemingly going on as doors are closed, fake lighting goes off, and Derek is dropped right before her. This is when I thought the whole thing of pulling him out and then putting him into this theater, just too goddamn convenient.
I also hate how over the top this is. Why putting him up on a cross? Oh my god, this is... If I wanted to watch this, I would have turned on Raw and watched Austin get hung up on that symbol by The Undertaker a couple years from now. That was less cartoonish than this bullshit.
Don't understand how he got there, because I wouldn't have thought that that's where his own frat would have brought him, because that wouldn't make any sense. I mean, the only way he would be, reason he'd be up here was to literally get down off your cross to commit the crimes when you're the killer. So I think it's a result of changes in editing. But you know what? We might as well start the fight now. I like the ending of this.
Oh my God. You can't. You can't. I feel like I'm having a nightmare. Here we go, boys. Here's the first reveal. Sydney slaps Derek awake as she says that the killer is there, and here he comes. She's asked if she really wants to trust her boyfriend, and then this killer unmasks, and it's dun-dun-dun, Mickey! So, Adam, you like this reveal, huh?
I thought it was so obvious that Mickey was the killer that he couldn't be. So, I don't know if I like the reveal, but I'm good with it. But I do like that it completely plays back into her being like, you can't trust your boyfriend, can you?
Yeah, I kind of like those callbacks as well. I'm just not sure about the emo fucking theater kid as being the killer. It's just too easy.
Yeah, and he looks like the villain. And the thing is also, like, with these type of movies, your first inclination is always to suspect new characters versus existing ones.
Mm-hmm. Mickey says that Derek abandoned him and he needs a partner and he couldn't have done this on his own. Derek says that he's lying, and Sydney won't untie him now as her boyfriend was the killer last time. Derek is then shot and dies on the spot. Mickey talks to Sydney about her trust issues, and he calls out that she doesn't have a mom. He says that he wants to get caught as he wants to blame the movies, and these days it's all about the trial and the effects of cinema violence on hapless people.
It's true. I mean, that
was the 90s way of thinking. I'll give it that.
That was the media way. That was me getting yelled at in a record store for buying the Matrix soundtrack. And I caused Columbine because of people like me.
Oh, my God.
I thought when Ghostface was going to rip off the mask, it was going to be Tipper Gore.
Jesus Christ. Mickey says that people love a good trial. And Billy knew that it was all about the execution. Sydney says one thing about Billy that Mickey is leaving out is that she fucking killed him. And the battle is on. Mickey,
I love Sydney here. Like, I like.
Yeah, me too.
You don't. I mean, I guess Nancy, you could look at that way from, you know, stood up to Freddy. But you don't see this in horror movies.
Mickey calls what Sid is doing very Linda Hamilton-esque as Gail appears. And right behind her is Debbie Salt, who we will come to know as Mrs. Loomis, Laurie Metcalf. And I'm going to say one good thing about this ending. This whole movie, it's been all about making callbacks to Scream. This is the one time it makes a new callback to a horror franchise. This is a callback to Friday the 13th, where the first Friday the 13th was Jason's mother, not Jason himself. So in that way, I like this reveal. However, it just feels so rewritten, which is exactly what it was. It's just too convenient and too left field. Where was Laurie Metcalf this entire movie? What kills was she doing? I don't know, and I don't think this movie knows either.
Well, that Friday the 13th callback is also beneficial because it's inverse. The second movie, the mom is the killer, which is sort of new. The problem is also there's never any foreshadowing that she's not who she appears to be, which makes this come out of nowhere. And they try to explain it by Sydney going, oh, you lost weight, which is stupid. That the only reason the characters don't recognize her is because of something like that. So when the movie has to justify its own decision with something that lazy versus either subtle foreshadowing or any clues with her whatsoever, it does not work at all.
All right, Adam, what do you say about this ending, sir? You like this reveal, huh?
I do. I like that it's, you know, that throwback to Friday the 13th. You know, I don't think that's missed by anybody who knows it. I like that it's not what you expect. You know, they could have made it Cotton, who lost his marbles. They could have made it anybody else. Mickey, I think, is almost the weak part of it. Luckily, she takes care of that. So I'm good with it. Is it great? Eh, you could have probably gone better ways, but I'm absolutely okay because it's a different way that you would have expected this movie to go. Who's going to expect the mom of Billy to be the killer by this? There's no way. So I like that it's not something that you would normally see. It's not something you would expect. It's not something you could have called other than, why is Laurie Metcalf in this movie? You know, that's about the only reason you could have called that she would have been the killer at the end.
Well, I want to ask you guys, since this reveal has happened, let's talk about who the original killers were. We were already mentioned it was Hallie. The other killer, they were going to go right back to the boyfriend. It was going to be Derek, Jerry O'Connell in this. And it was going to be revealed that Hallie and Jerry O'Connell were having an affair this entire movie. How do we feel that would have worked?
I think using the boyfriend again would have been lazy. I think that would have been just an easy, lazy trope, and just because of an affair, I don't know. I don't think it would have stuck the landing.
I have to close my lips because I have thoughts for a future movie.
Okay. Make sure when we get there you mention this as well, okay?
Oh, I have it. I have it saved.
Okay. We learn that this is Billy's mother after a makeover, as Matt mentioned. Mickey says that he needed financing, and she was all in after what happened to her son. She appears and shoots Mickey, saying that there won't be a trial, and then shoots Gail, saying that she wants to kill two birds with one stone. She then says that she's very sane, and that her motive isn't as 90s as Mickey's. She just wanted revenge for Sydney killing her son. She goes over each scenario that she's going to tell the cops when they appear, and Sydney says that she's as crazy as her son was. Mrs. Loomis says that she was a good mother and that she's sick of people saying it's all the fault of the parents. She also says that
I also like this is kind of the inverse of Norman Bates.
You took my. I was waiting for that ever since the shower shot at the beginning. God damn it. No, she does everything but say a boy's best friend is his mother.
She then says that Sydney doesn't know what it is being a mother and raising a child. And I do like this trick that Sydney plays. Isn't Mickey supposed to be dead? Like, she says that just to distract Mrs. Loomis, and then the chase is on. That was a nice little touch.
This is why Sydney should have been a psychology major. You fix this climax.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree. Doesn't solve everything, but it also eliminates my theater problem.
That's a good point, because that is a fake-out. Sydney knows all the theater tricks and uses them all on Mrs. Loomis, so we have fake rocks and fake towers falling, and Mrs. Loomis is knocked down and buried.
Look at Courtney Cox. This looks like it was it would cost about as much as Masters of the Universe.
Right.
They don't use bricks in theater. These things are styrofoam.
I know. She's still not done and attacks Sydney with a vengeance. She has her down as the knife gets closer. Here comes Cotton. He says that he's had a very bad day and he'd like to know what's going on. Sid informs him as Mrs. Loomis has a knife to her throat. Loomis begs him to let her kill Sydney, and then he can have the spotlight of being the star. And it's only fitting as Sydney's the one who sent Cotton to prison for a year. Cotton says that he's in quite the predicament, as Mrs. Loomis is making quite the point. He then says that he bets that Diane Sawyer interview is looking great. Sydney says, consider it done, as he shoots and kills Mrs. Loomis. I guess you can call it the arc of Cotton here, as he's been throwing in her face, in Sydney's face this entire time. Look, we need to do this interview, and Sydney's been putting it aside and like not even agreeing to it. It is only when she agrees to it that he kills the actual killer of this movie. I thought that was a kind of nice touch.
I think it's weird because it makes him almost sociopathic in his own way. You know, he doesn't help until he gets his way. It's amazing this was my introduction to Leif Schreiber, because it's just, of all the work that he's done, this is almost the weirdest kind of thing. But I like that he shows up. I think he's here so much in this movie because they were going to possibly use him as a killer at one point. But I'm down with this. I mean, you figure what the first movie is based on and the person that she put into prison, now they're a team at the end of this to get out of it. It's a way to go. Again, great? No. But it's good for me. Like, I'm absolutely good with this.
Yeah, it is almost like seeing Lawrence Fishburne in the third Nightmare on Elm Street film. It's like, what are you doing here?
Especially with his hair.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I'm going to use another wrestling analogy, because why stop now?
Okay.
This is a swerve and a babyface turn just because someone wanted to do it.
You think this is a complete rewrite then? You don't think this was actually planned?
Oh, this whole climax, I can hear the writing of the pen or the typing of a keyboard as they're trying to pencil this together like Frankenstein.
Cotton says, boy, that was intense, as Sydney stands and takes the gun. Cotton says that they need to talk about what really happened here as Gail appears once again. Cotton tells her that she has more lives than a cat as they look at Mrs. Loomis and wonder if she's really dead. Sydney says they always come back as Mickey raises up and both her and Gail unload their clips at him. I thought that was a funny touch.
No, sometimes they come back.
Sometimes they come back. Yeah. Because I can't believe that's the line they used.
Yeah, call back that nice property. Sydney then shoots Mrs. Loomis in the head and says, just in case, as she drops her gun and leaves. We then see Joel, the cameraman, ask Gail if she's all right, as Dewey once again appears, and we see that Dewey is, once again, still alive. I don't know. Were there thoughts of killing him here? I would imagine this is, once again, that same joke from that first film, and they weren't planning anything else here.
I don't know what to believe. Maybe they shot a death scene for him and they said, you know, we'll use it depending on what test audiences want. Because everything from the moment she gets in the car. Sydney gets in the car. The movie just to me feels like I'm watching the directing equivalent of Mad Libs.
I think it was that way for Dewey and for Gale. I think they shot them both dying. I think they shot them both living. And
Interesting.
I think as they got to decide, because they talk about, it gets cut off earlier. And he's talking about, what do you need for a franchise? Well, the third thing you need is, and you never hear the end of it. Guess what you need for a franchise? You need two people to continue on when your star is going to leave you.
Save it for next week. Gale tells Dewey to hang in there as he's wheeled into the ambulance and she goes with him. Sydney then gives Cotton the credit for being the hero and he says that there's a time and place and proof for everything and they need to give him a call. He ends things by saying it'll make one hell of a movie as credits roll on Scream 2, boys. Oh boy. 1997 in a nutshell. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Scream 2? I'll go to the man who seems to be more positive on this than the other two. Adam, you go ahead, sir.
Not having seen this in a very, very long time. Not having seen anything since it. I had no idea what to expect. I enjoyed Scream so much, and I know the indelible mark that that has left kind of on franchise and meta commentary and such. I didn't know what to expect of this one. I remembered very, very little. As I was watching it, certain scenes popped up though, and I got it. And then when this thing started, the first scene, that opening, I was like, oh man, this is going to just, okay. It's going to be a struggle to get through. And then it flipped. Once we got to college, once we got the introduction of the other characters, once we got the story moving, I was invested in this. And I enjoyed the whodunit aspect. I enjoyed the why done it aspect. As much as it's not, who is the killer. And the first one, part of that aspect is there. This is more of the why the killer is even coming back. And I enjoyed that a lot. I enjoyed that way more than I thought I would. For Scream, I found the movie was kind of inconsistent throughout. In this one, I found that after the opening scene, this movie progresses better. And I found myself enjoying myself more. I liked everybody that was in this. I liked what Courtney Cox did. I liked what David Arquette did. I liked seeing Liev Schreiber in this. I think that Neve Campbell is freaking amazing as Sydney. I just liked that character a lot. And I had forgotten how much I did. I think Scream 2 holds up stunningly well. I think the kills are good. I think the sequel-ish commentary is very well done. And I gotta say, by the end of the film, I found myself having a more complete experience than I did with last week's film. So I'm going to give this the same score, but it would be a point higher if I was given a half a point. So I'm giving Scream 2 a 7, even though I liked it better than Scream. I was surprised how much I enjoyed this film because I thought it jumped off a cliff right away, but I think it actually got improved.
Jesus fucking Christ.
It's got to be one.
7 on 10. I can't believe I said that from Adam Bunch. Matt, please land this ship back on Earth.
Well, I could go multiple ways with that because we had landing a ship go horribly in Titanic, and maybe that's an alien resurrection joke, both of which came out in 1997. So this movie is sort of the mirror dimension equivalent or the mirror dimension version of the first one because this one has a terrible opening and, in my opinion, a terrible climax. But I think the second act is the strongest part of the movie, which is the direct opposite of the first film in both ways for me. What saves it is, I think, Sydney is the, I would argue, the best final girl of these slasher films, of the recurring ones. And I do think, as arm-crossed and cross-legged as I am at bringing everybody back, like the gang's all here, I enjoy most of their presences, even though with characters like Randy and Dewey, I think they're kind of question their return, and even when they're here, I wonder why you're not doing more with them. But as a whodunit and looking at it through the lens of that, which the first one tracks very well and I think handles that much better, this one is slot. They should have called Wes Craven's janitor to clean up this mess because, good Lord, it's leaving a trail of slime in that whole theater. It's the excuse is there because they had the leaks, but that doesn't excuse something that is this, stitched together. And it really sours me on the overall movie. The Loomis one, I'm okay with that because that is having fun with some past tropes. But I saw Mickey being the killer the moment I saw the words Timothy Oliphant listed in the cast. So I'm going to give it a I'm gonna give it a 5. I sat through it. It's okay. But I don't think it has anywhere near the tightness or the freshness, the Febreze-like scent that the first one was able to perfume in the horror landscape.
5 on 10 from Mr. Goudreau. You know, I came into this, like last week, I came into this not really thinking good thoughts about it. And here's the thing, I am a complete inverse of Adam in that I think it starts off pretty well. I think the opening kills, I think I'm a little more high on them than you guys are. I'm not going to say they're great, but I'm going to call them a nice college try. They're very drawn out, but so was last week's first kill. But here's the thing, last week's opening kill, we saw Drew Barrymore screaming, running, getting more intense, getting just completely obliterated by the calls on the phone. In the opening of this, we're not getting that. And I'll say it again. Whereas last week's movie played on the entire horror genre, this movie is playing on Scream. And the few times it separates itself from that, I think it's a pretty fun time. And I think the kills are okay. They're not up to the standards of last week's movie. I did have a decent time watching it. I think it's a little overlong. It's 2 hours. This thing should have been at least 15 minutes shorter. But I think the way it plays itself to the very end, and I am complete lockstep with Matt in saying, as soon as Sydney and Hallie get in that car, this fucking movie takes a nosedive and they cannot pull the nose up. I think Neve Campbell is at least as good as last week, if not better. I think she's the only character who improves this week as opposed to last week. And I liked her a lot last week. And I think a lot of this is kind of pasted on a whiteboard. Okay, who would work as the killer? Okay, if that doesn't work, what would work? Oh, shit. Shit leaked? We better change that. So we're going to move these people around and let's create an arc for this. I'm not going to blame these filmmakers for what happened, because who would have suspected in 1997 that an internet leak would completely turn your final act around? But unlike Adam, I cannot go with the final act of this. I think everything having to do with Sydney and being in theater is stupid, and I think the ending is stupid, with the exception of the fact that it's the mom once again doing the killing. I have the same score as Matt written down here. I have a 5. It's not as bad as I was suspecting. I was expecting at least a 4 on the lower end, but I still had a decent time watching it. I just wish it was better written. And it's not as clever as it thinks it is, unlike last week's film where I thought that was really, really clever. So 5 on 10 for Scream 2. If 2/3 of this podcast gave this movie a 5, I cannot imagine what's going to happen next week when we get to Scream 3, a movie that is looked at by a lot of people as being the, let's call it the black sheep of the franchise. I don't remember too much of it. I remember an aspect of it that I don't like when it's shown in any movie, which is we are going to get the behind the scenes of a movie as it's being made. That's the only thing I remember. Oh, and Courtney Cox's hair, which Adam's already pointed out. Matt, what are you expecting when we get to Scream 3 next week?
A lot of Creed music, which, God, if you need any further proof that movie was made in 2000, there's your answer. All I remember is the whole, I remember the crux of the movie with filming a movie, like it's the next circle of meta hell. If the second one is showing a stab movie, the third one is making a stab movie. Outside of that, and the bangs that are so awful that you want to put curtains over her head, I remember next to nothing. I hope I'm more positive because I don't remember giving a good review last time, but I also can see a world where I'm not going to be as harsh as I was because of the word Scream 3. So we'll see.
All right, Adam. Is this where you lost track? Is this, have you seen next week's film?
I've seen no further Scream no from further here on screams. Out.
Okay, so next week on, it will
all I don't even know what time. It's about. I'm assuming it's a horror movie.
Well, I just gave you the answer, genius.
And I'm assuming it's more than using a butcher knife on Courtney Cox's bangs. So I've no idea. Haven't even seen I probably saw the trailer 20 years ago, but could not speak to it.
Do you remember Jenny McCarthy being in next week's film?
I remember Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to be talking about her next week.
Oh, Wahlberg.
All right. That'll be next week. Man, what an animated discussion we just had about the second sequel of a huge series of films that's going to cultivate in a brand new review. What's it called, Matt? Scream 7? Is it actually called Scream 7?
I think it's just called Scream.
I think it's just called no, it no, because that was the fifth one.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this one, it has to be Scream 7.
Okay, so it's going to cultivate.
Yep, it says Scream 7 on the poster. That's
All
what I'm
right,
going.
so it'll cultivate in a review of Scream 7. And like always, there's no guarantee we'll get it week of release, but we'll get it as soon as we can. Boys, I've had a blast discussing these first two Scream movies with you. We'll see what happens next week when we get to Scream 3. But I have a feeling it's going to be much more fun to talk about than watch. But we'll see. But until next week, when we talk Scream 3. It's a perfect example of life imitating podcasts imitating life. Thank you, boys.
The past will come back to bite you in the ass. Whatever you think you know about the past, forget it. The past is not at rest. Any sins you think were committed in the past are about to break out and destroy you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Wow. That was intense.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
But us, we gonna carry on and plan the sequel, because let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews, such as the Alien film series, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
The reason I'm here is to help you.
Scream retrospective introduction performed by Adam and Sarai, directed by Garrett. Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
It could be fucking Reservoir Dogs by the time this thing is through.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
By definition alone, they're inferior films.
It's bullshit generalization. Many sequels have surpassed their original.
Oh, yeah?
Name one.
Yeah.
Aliens. Far better than the first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Thank you, Ridley Scott rules.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What did you just say?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This is all because of you.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
So how can I help you? Or do you want me to tell you who you look like?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Now welcome to the final act.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Now, Sid, don't you blame the movies! Movies don't create psychos! Movies make psychos more creative!
So, in closing, let me say good luck, Godspeed, and for some of you, I'll see you soon.
It's funny, because Laura got me, you know, the AMC A-list.
Mm-hmm.
But did you see AMC just put out a popcorn bucket or a popcorn, like, yearly subscription?
No,
I didn't. $30 gets me half off large popcorn for a year. So I did the quick math. I only need to buy 6 popcorns. I'm like, oh, shit. I feel like John Panette when he talks about getting to the buffet. I'm like, this is where I make my money back.
Okay.
True. Yep. And, you know, Omar Epps, I don't know if he's going to stay with the Pittsburgh Steelers, but I always wish him the best.
Jesus Christ.
I've loved him forever. I forgot he was actually in this opening. I remembered her, but not him.
Yeah, so Foreman does the unsmart thing of putting his face to the wall, and he gets a knife to the ear. Ouch.
In certain bathrooms, you get something else.
Luckily, there wasn't a hole in the stall.
Like scary movie has ruined this whole scene.
Yes, it has.
You guys, everybody out there, take a shot every time they mention Scary Movie. You will be dead by the end of these podcasts.
It's hard not to, because I think in the first Scary Movie, that whole bit with the like knocking this opening is the funniest part of the movie, including the bit where she's eating in the theater and is like unwrapping. She brings like a whole pot roast dinner.
The guy.
I feel like those are the roles Jerry O'Connell could have gotten if he was a little bit more talented.
Adam, remember My Secret Identity?
Yes, I do.
That's what he was fresh on my mind as when I was watching this way back when. We cut to...
Two people that... Well, yeah, I'll say Gayheart never does anything for me. Even her hair is just she wishes she was Noxzema Girl. But Portia de Rossi does some really good work on Ally McBeal here. It's funny that they're probably the youngest ones, but they feel older than everybody else in this film.
Wasn't Gayheart Dylan's girlfriend? That was who played her, right? On Beverly Hills 90210, who dies?
Oh, Tony?
Yeah, I can't remember.
That was...
I don't know.
I can't remember. Never mind. We get the Dewey... Oh, I'm sorry. Matt, did you think there was any...
See... This gets into a problem I have with this movie in general. I'm nowhere near as interested in trying to deduce who the killer is compared to the first one. I mean, speaking of Tori Spelling, she's in Scary Movie 2.
Yes! God damn it, you guys. All right, so we're getting the...
I think this is screenwriting douchebaggery. I think this is Quentin Tarantino, just a style of, oh, the movies are so fucking important, and an actress and a screenwriter is so fucking important, and acting is therapy. Like, that's how it comes across to me. Because not only would she not do it, but her teacher for it, with long lost, you know, great actor, and he'll always be Sark to me from Tron, but he puts her in some utterly shitty positions for what she's gone through.
We need to do the Tarantino retro just so he can talk like that.
I know.
But that's also why I refuse to do a Woody Allen retrospective, because my voice would be shot by week 3 and we'd have to do 40 something goddamn movies.
I mean, I love his films, but just because of him being in the press so much these last weeks, I can't not take shots at him.
Well, especially now that Kill Bill, Whole Bloody
Affair. Yeah, I was about ready to say my friend saw it yesterday. He said it was great.
Yeah, that's 4.5 hours.
I don't want to sit in a theater for 4 hours.
Yeah, that's the same here. That's why me and Jen aren't going to go, hell, we're going to see fucking Avatar here in a couple of weeks. That's going to be long enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's 3 hours.
Yeah.
I made it through Killers of the Flower Moon, but that's only because I went to a pristine theater that has the reclining seats.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I went to the only theaters that are playing the whole bloody affair around me are the ones where it's like stadium seating and there's no like footrest or anything. So I know I'd be uncomfortable and kind of antsy. So I'll wait till it comes out in some form of media, hopefully. And
I have both discs and I don't need to pay for $30 for an extra 15 minutes of anime.
Yeah. I'm good. I'll read the differences and be like, oh, that's cool. Next.
And I'm talking about how much you hate AMC again. You're not going to go to AMC to see an old movie, right? Never mind.
I am now that I have A-list.
Sorry, everyone. Our GPS took us out of Woodsboro.
So Dewey says, and Adam, to your point of saying this is all she gives, I'm going to be saying this a lot in the next couple of years, but if you watch Buffy, she gives a lot, and your heart bleeds for her in that. She is excellent on that show. I just find this is a complete waste of her, and it kill me watching this. I remember being pissed off the first time, but going back to it, I was even more pissed off watching it this time.
Was the show out and big at this
time? Yes. Oh, yeah. This was already in the second season at this time.
Oh, so second season. So it was... Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, and some people call the second season its peak, and I'm actually...
No. I do not agree with that.
Which one would you think is its peak? Third? With the school?
Three or... maybe four.
I don't know, man. Her killing Angel in this season kills me every time.
Spoiler, save it for the Buffy cast.
Because four has some of my favorite episodes. Something Blue, Hush.
Hush. Yeah, that's a good point.
The Initiative.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Initiative was...
Like, it's got some really good episodes.
You are speaking Greek to me, and not just because we're...
Now you know how I feel when you guys go on and on about fucking Punisher TV shows, for Christ's sake. We go back to the sorority party. Matt, you and I got to do a podcast about that one day.
Yeah, well, you we'll do that. Adam gets, we'll subject him to Smallville.
Yeah, yeah.
So Adam and I can just yell at you for 7 years about how much the show blows.
We go back to the sorority party as Sydney is just... And Adam, to your point of saying this is all she gives, I'm going to be saying this a lot in the next couple of years, but if you watch Buffy, she gives a lot, and your heart bleeds for her in that. She is excellent on that show. I just find this is a complete waste of her, and it kills me watching this. I remember being pissed off the first time, but going back to it, I was even more pissed off watching it this time.
Was the show out and big at this
yes.
time?
Yes. Oh, yeah. This was already in the second season at this time.
Oh, so second season. So it was... Okay.
Yeah, sorry, and some people call the second season its peak, and I'm actually...
No. I do not agree with that.
Which one would you think is its peak? Third? With the school?
Three or maybe four.
I don't know, man. Her killing Angel in this season kills me every time.
Spoiler, save it for the Buffy cast.
Because four has some of my favorite episodes. Something Blue, Hush.
Hush, yeah, that's a good point.
The Initiative.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Initiative was...
Like, it's got some really good episodes.
Oh, you are speaking Greek to me, and not just because we're...
Now you know how I feel when you guys go on and on about fucking Punisher TV shows, for Christ's sake. We go back to the sorority party. Matt, you and I got to do a podcast about that one day.
We'll do that. Adam gets... We'll subject him to Smallville.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Adam and I can just yell at you for 7 years about how much the show blows.
We go back to the sorority party as Sydney is just...
It's bad when you reference it to, not to piss Garrett off again, she joins the Scary Movie franchise. So it's hard to... I mean, she plays both sides of the fence, and good for her.
Speaking of Smallville, she was a pretty cool character on that show as well.
Was she one of like the villains of the week?
Yeah. Remember, she was the reporter that could turn into water. Remember that? And then she overheard.
No, the only one I really remember of those was Amy Adams.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Eater.
We gotta show Adam that episode if he's never seen it.
Oh yeah, it's quite an episode. She eats people, and
she's got the hunger. Is it the hunger?
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I've listened to the podcast. I listen to Talkville, but I've never watched
Smallville. How weird is that? He listens to Talkville. He doesn't watch the goddamn show.
That's like the people who read dirt sheets but don't watch wrestling.
Speaking of David Arquette.
Yeah, right? Yeah, speaking of him, we got him in the next scene, so...
I half expected Ghostface to take off the mask, and it was,
Keanu Reeves?
Oh. No. What's a fucking name? The guy who was saying video games, Tipper Gore.
Oh my god, yes.
Say that one more time. So that
I thought when Ghostface was going to rip off the mask, it was going to be Tipper Gore. I have to close my lips because I have thoughts for a future movie.
Okay. Make sure when we get there, you mention this as well, okay?
Oh, I have it. I have it saved.
Okay. All right.
Fair enough. I've rewatched all these.
Okay. God damn it. Why do you go ahead? All right.
Oh, says the guy who's watched every Stephen King property under the sun.
I was like, you've got the next 20 King books fucking lined up.
I do. You guys are just making, you guys are just being superstars right underneath my nose.
I'm going to hit myself with a fucking taser to watch another episode of The Incredible Hulk.
We learn that. Mrs. Loomis says that she was a good mother and that she's sick of people saying that it's all her fault. Oh, I already said that. I'm sorry. She then says that she. But we'll see. But until next week, when we talk Scream 3, it's a perfect example of podcasts imitating life. It's a perfect example of life imitating podcasts imitating life.
All right, that's enough. That'll be a wrap. The sequel discussion to be continued.